So if you really break it down, the most fundamental truth of ice hockey is actually pretty simple. It's this idea that the puck moves faster than any skater ever could.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the inescapable reality of the sport, right?
Right, because you just can't outskate five opposing players. It doesn't matter who you are. But if you understand the geometry of the ice, you can absolutely outpass them.
Yeah. And we obsess over stopwatches, you know, and straight line speed and athletics. But the moment you step onto a sheet of ice, the physical reality of that puck just completely overrides individual speed.
Because it's what, just a 6-ounce piece of vulcanized rubber?
Exactly. Sliding on a frozen surface with almost zero friction. I mean, the fastest player in the world is still vastly slower than that puck.
And honestly, that reality is the perfect foundation for this deep dive. Because our mission today isn't just to, like, summarize a few passing drills.
Right. We want to go way deeper than that.
Yeah, we are building a complete integrated mental model here. We're looking at passing and receiving mechanics, situational tactics, and those incredibly nuanced rules that govern all of it.
Which is so important because a lot of players just rely on instinct without really understanding the why.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So by the end of this hour, you, the listener, are going to understand the philosophy of the game like an elite playmaker.
Yeah.
We're treating you like a serious student of the game who wants to truly master it.
That is definitely the right approach because, you know, passing is something that gets drilled endlessly in practice, but receiving.
Receiving is just kind of assumed, right? Just catch it.
Yeah, it's merely assumed. But today, we are going to treat both halves of that puck movement equation as equal rigorous sciences.
I love that. Equal sciences.
We're going to explore the mechanics, the actual physics of why certain plays work, and the really common traps that players fall into. And that applies whether you're stepping on the ice for the very first time or, you know, you've been playing in adult beer leagues for 20 years.
So to kick us off and really get your brain primed for this active learning style we're doing today, I actually have a question for you, the listener.
A little retrieval prompt to start things off.
Exactly. So before we even start breaking down the physics, I want you to just think about how you view the ice. Like when you're watching a game on TV or playing in one, are you aiming your passes where your teammate is currently standing?
Right.
Or are you aiming where they will be in the future? Just keep that mental image in your head as we go through this.
That question really gets the absolute core philosophy of offensive hockey. Because before we even talk about the physical biomechanics of, you know, how to physically pass a puck, we have to establish why moving it is always superior to carrying it.
Okay, yeah, let's establish that baseline. Why is passing always better?
Well, when a single player just carries the puck up the ice, they concentrate all the risk on themselves.
Makes sense.
Right. So the defending team doesn't actually have to make any complex decisions. All five defenders get to share a single, very predictable reference point.
They just track the guy with the puck.
Exactly. They just set their gaps, match your speed, and steer you into a corner. It's easy to defend.
Right. But a pass changes all of that.
It changes the entire spatial reality of the game in a fraction of a second. When you complete a pass, it forces all five opponents to completely reread the ice.
They have to physically turn their heads.
Yes. Turn their heads, shift their momentum, and re-choose their defensive assignments on the fly. And that momentary chaos, that scrambling, that is where offense is actually generated.
Now, I assume this doesn't mean you should literally never carry the puck, right? There have to be exceptions.
Oh, for sure. There are very distinct exceptions. I mean, you carry the puck when absolutely nobody is open, obviously.
Right. Don't force a pass to nobody.
Exactly. You also carry it when a defender has terrible gap control and you can just exploit their bad positioning. Or, and this is a higher level tactic, you carry it to deliberately draw pressure toward yourself.
To kind of act like bait.
Yeah, act like bait to buy time for your supporting players to arrive in the zone. But structurally, passing must be your default weapon.
Okay, so assuming passing is our default, let's look at what the source material calls the biggest philosophical divide in the game.
The space versus tape debate.
Yes. Because I always assumed, you know, as a casual player, that a good pass hits a guy right on the blade of his stick. But our materials make this massive distinction between passing onto the tape, versus passing into space.
And it is a crucial distinction.
Walk me through why aiming for the stick is actually considered a trap.
It's a massive trap because passing onto the tape means the puck arrives exactly at the receiver's current physical location.
Which sounds good in theory.
Right, but that's only the correct decision when the receiver is completely stationary. Like, say, a defenseman who is quarterbacking a power play from the point, or maybe a forward who is parked right in the slot and is actively loading up for a shot.
Okay, so if they aren't moving, hit the tape.
Exactly. But in almost every other scenario, especially in transition, when you're moving up the ice at speed, you want to pass into space.
And this is all because of momentum, right? Like, I'm picturing a winger just flying down the left side of the ice, hitting those crossover strides to build maximum speed.
That's the perfect example. So imagine that winger is moving at, let's say, 20 miles per hour. If you pass the puck to the exact spot where their stick blade is, at the exact moment you release the pass,
they won't be there anymore.
Exactly. By the time the puck travels 40 feet across the ice, that winger has already skated way past that original spot. The pass is now trailing them.
So to catch it, they'd have to, like, reach backward.
Reach backward, break their stride, slow down, or even physically turn their whole torso around. And every single one of those corrective actions completely kills the kinetic energy that made the play dangerous in the first place.
You're just doing the defense's job for them by slowing your own guy down.
Precisely. So passing into space means the puck arrives at a geometric point ahead of the receiver. It's perfectly timed so they can skate onto it without ever breaking their forward stride.
It honestly reminds me so much of an elite quarterback in football throwing like a slant route.
That's a really good analogy, yeah.
Because the quarterback isn't throwing the football at the receiver's jersey, right? They're throwing the ball to a patch of grass 10 yards downfield, totally trusting that the receiver's speed will carry them to that exact patch of grass at the exact moment the ball arrives.
That is the exact same physics, yes.
But here's where I get a little confused when we translate that to the ice. Because a football receiver runs a set, pre-planned route. A hockey player is just reading and reacting in pure chaos.
Right. There are no set routes in hockey.
So how do you judge the lead? I mean, how do you know their exact speed without having some kind of telepathy?
Well, it definitely looks like telepathy from the stands. I'll give you that. But it's actually just applied biomechanics. The real secret here is that you have to read the receiver's skates, not their chest.
Read the skates. Why not the chest? I feel like the chest is the biggest target.
Because chests lie.
Wait, chests lie? What do you mean?
I mean, a player's torso can be twisted in any direction. They might be looking backward over their shoulder to yell for the puck, or they might be pointing their chest toward the middle of the ice just to deceive a defender.
Oh, wow. Okay, so if I pass to where their chest is facing,
you'll miss them entirely. But their skates. Their skates show you their true, undeniable physical trajectory. The skates dictate the actual physical path their center of mass is taking.
So a playmaker is literally looking down at the feet.
Well, taking in the whole picture, but yes, relying on those visual cues. The length of the teammate's stride, the frequency of their crossovers, the exact direction the toes on their gliding skate are pointing.
So you're constantly doing this kind of subconscious calculus in your head. You have to balance the speed of the receiver with the speed of your own pass.
Precisely. It's an equation with two variables. If you have a phenomenally fast receiver, you obviously need to provide a much longer lead into space.
Because they'll eat up that ice quickly.
Right. But if you're throwing a really hard, fast pass, the puck will cover the distance quicker, so you actually need a shorter lead.
That is a lot to process in a split second.
It is, which is why there is a golden rule of thumb for anyone learning this mental model. When in doubt, always lead them slightly forward.
Always lead forward. Because it's easier to speed up than slow down.
It's biomechanically impossible to skate backward at high speed to retrieve a pass while still maintaining your forward momentum. It just can't be done.
Right, you just fall over.
Yeah, but if the pass is ahead of you, you can always just dig in and accelerate to catch up to it. If it's behind you, the play is dead.
Okay, let's do a quick mental check-in for the listener here to make sure this is cementing. If we are trying to build this mental model of passing, the core takeaway of our philosophy so far is what? Read the feet, lead forward, and revel them.
Pass to the future, not the present.
Pass to the future.
I love that. Okay, so now that we understand the philosophy of where to aim, we really need to look at the physical tools required to get the puck to that future spot. Let's talk about the actual biomechanics of the pass itself.
Absolutely. And before we even look at the hands or the stick, there's an absolute non-negotiable prerequisite for passing
Which
mechanics.
is
Your head must be up, constantly scanning the ice, always.
right, you can't pass to someone you don't see.
Exactly. If you have to look down at the puck on your stick just to control it, your passing ability is entirely capped by your stick handling ability. You have to be able to scan the ice and identify your passing lanes before you even physically receive the puck.
So you have to feel the puck on your blade rather than see it. That's a tough skill to master. So let's break down the absolute bread and butter of hockey, the flat sweep pass. What is actually happening mechanically when a pro delivers a perfect flat pass that doesn't wobble at all?
It's a sequence of very specific physical actions. First, you start the puck near the heel of your stick blade, not the middle or the toe. Okay, near the heel.
Yeah, and your bottom hand should be roughly mid-shaft to provide leverage. But the most critical mechanical step here is cupping the blade over the puck.
Okay, stop there because you have to explain cupping. I see casual players with their blades wide open all the time.
Oh, it's the most common mistake. Cupping means you actively tilt your wrists so that the top edge of the stick blade leans forward, effectively closing the face of the blade over the top of the puck.
As opposed to an open blade.
Right. An open blade acts exactly like a golf wedge. It sends the puck up on its edge, making it wobble, flip, and just bounce all over the ice. A cupped blade physically traps the puck against the ice surface, forcing it to remain flat.
Okay, I have that visual. So the puck is at the heel, the blade is cupped. What's the actual passing motion?
The motion is a sweep, not a slap. That's vital. You push the puck along the ice in one smooth, continuous acceleration.
So you're not winding up.
No wind up. And as your arms move forward, the puck naturally rolls from the heel of your blade along the curve till it releases right off the toe. That heel-to-toe roll is what generates the flat spin.
Now, I have to admit, this is where I personally struggle. When I'm playing and I feel back pressure, a defender breathing down my neck, my absolute first instinct is to just slap at the puck to get rid of it quickly.
Oh, it's panic. Everyone does it.
Yeah. It just feels like a slap pass is inherently faster than taking the time to sweep it. Why is slapping so universally discouraged in the materials?
Well, it might feel faster to execute the physical motion of a slap, but it destroys your accuracy, your power, and the quality of the puck's rotation. Let's just look at the raw physics of it.
Okay, let's hear the physics.
Slapping creates a single chaotic instant of kinetic contact. When you slap, the blade strikes the puck for a fraction of a millisecond.
Right.
So if your blade angle is off by even 1 millimeter at that exact microscopic moment of impact, the puck will fly wildly off target.
Because you literally have no time to correct it.
You have zero time. Sweeping, on the other hand, provides a guided path. You maintain physical contact and control over the puck for the entire duration of the stroke. You are actively guiding its trajectory.
So it's about control over chaos.
Exactly. Furthermore, slapping doesn't actually generate true power. And this is a huge misconception. True power in a pass doesn't come from your arms just swatting at the rubber.
So where does it come from? Because my arms definitely get tired.
It comes from the kinetic chain. Power comes from your weight transfer.
Oh, like hitting a baseball.
Very similar. As you begin the sweep, your weight should be loaded on your back leg. Then, as you push the puck forward, you drive off that back skate, transferring your body weight through your hips, into your core, down your shoulders, and finishing on your front foot.
So the arms are just the final delivery mechanism.
Exactly. Passes that are generated only by the arms tend to just float gently over the ice, and floating passes get intercepted. Passes driven by a full body weight transfer have a heavy snapping pace to them. They're much harder to pick off.
And what about the follow-through? How important is what happens after the puck actually leaves the stick?
Oh, the follow-through is the ultimate physical hack. It's what guarantees your accuracy.
A physical hack? How so?
Because human reaction time is simply not fast enough to consciously meter the exact angle of a stick blade in the middle of a high-speed dynamic motion. You just can't think that fast.
Right, it's all muscle memory.
But if you discipline yourself to finish your follow-through low to the ice, with the toe of your blade pointing precisely at your intended target, your body's biomechanics will automatically ensure that the blade face was at the correct angle at the exact moment the puck separated from it.
So pointing at the target is almost like a calibration tool for your muscles.
That's a great way to put it. Yes, it calibrates the release.
That makes total sense. Okay, now let's shift to the other side of the blade, because the material we're looking at literally refers to the backhand pass as, quote, the half of the game most players skip. Why is it so universally neglected?
Mostly because it feels incredibly awkward when you first learn it, and mechanically, it is difficult to generate the same speed as a forehand pass.
It definitely feels weaker.
It does, but neglecting your backhand literally halves your options on the ice. Think about the geometry of the game. Every single physical position you find yourself in has a left side and a right side.
Right.
If you can only distribute the puck off your forehand, you are forced to physically turn your entire torso to make half of the potential plays on the ice.
And turning your body takes time. Time you don't have.
Exactly. And even worse, it broadcasts your intentions to the entire arena. Defenders are highly trained to recognize these
Oh,
limitations.
so they exploit it.
Constantly, if a smart checker realizes you refuse to pass on your backhand, they will deliberately overplay your forehand side. They will literally take away the ice on your strong side, forcing you to turn to your weak side.
Because they know the physical turn will slow you down and probably kill the play.
Right. You become utterly predictable. A competent backhand pass doesn't have to be a highlight reel rocket. It just has to be functional enough that the defender is forced to respect both sides of your body.
Keep them honest. So mechanically, how do we actually build a functional backhand? It feels so different from the forehand.
Well, surprisingly, the underlying principles are practically identical.
Really?
Yeah. You still start the puck at the heel or the middle of the blade on your backhand side, but instead of pushing, you are pulling. You pull heavily with your bottom hand, sweeping the puck across your body.
So you still want that heel to toe
You
roll.
still want that heel to toe roll to generate the spin, yes. And just like the forehand, the power has to come from the body, not the arms. You have to drive through the motion with your lower shoulder, really rotating your torso to transfer your weight.
Okay, let's pause here and do another retrieval check for the listener. Based on what we just discussed, what is the fundamental difference in power generation between a good pass and a bad pass?
Right. Think about it. A bad pass relies entirely on arm strength and swatting. A good pass, whether it's on the forehand or the backhand, generates power through a kinetic weight transfer from the back leg through the hips to the front leg.
Brilliant. Okay, now let's complicate things a little bit, because the sweep pass is the ideal tool for perfectly clear ice. But hockey is played in a confined space filled with obstacles, opposing sticks, skates, bodies, and the physical walls of the rink.
It's a chaotic environment.
So what tools do we pull from the arsenal when the direct flat lane on the ice is completely blocked?
This is where we get into situational passing. And the most famous tool in this specific category is the saucer pass.
Ah, the saucer pass.
Yes, the saucer pass is utilized specifically when you need to navigate the puck over a physical obstacle on the ice, which is usually a defender's stick blade lying flat in the passing lane, but you still need the puck to land flat and controllable for your receiver.
I have to say, I love watching a perfectly executed saucer pass. It looks like a perfectly flighted wedge shot in golf, just hovering over the ice. How is that flight actually achieved mechanically?
You actually use a very similar wedge principle to golf. Unlike the flat pass where you cup the blade closed, for a saucer pass, you have to open the face of the blade slightly.
Okay, so you're leaning it backward.
Right. You still utilize a heel-to-toe sweep, but as you follow through, you roll your wrists upward and you slice the blade slightly inward toward your own body.
What does that slice do?
That motion imparts a massive amount of lateral spin on the puck as it leaves the toe of the stick.
Why is the spin so important, though? Like, why not just quickly flip it up in the air?
Because of aerodynamics. A puck that's just flipped into the air without spin will tumble end over end. It'll catch the air resistance and it'll land chaotically on its edge, bouncing everywhere.
Right. It turns into a nightmare to catch.
But the lateral spin from a saucer pass acts as a gyroscope. It stabilizes the puck in flight, keeping it perfectly parallel to the ice. And that ensures that when it finally lands, it lands flat on its face rather than bouncing.
That makes perfect sense. But there has to be a catch. Like, it can't be the perfect tool for every situation.
There is a massive catch, and it's a limitation that players constantly ignore which leads to so many turnovers. You must engineer the pass so that it lands on the ice a few feet short of the receiver's stick.
Wait, really? You don't want it to land right on their tape?
Absolutely not. Think about the friction involved. A saucer pass that strikes the receiver's blade while it is still airborne is incredibly difficult to catch.
Because it's coming in hot.
The kinetic energy is just too high, and the puck will almost certainly explode off their stick. You have to land it short so that the friction of the ice can actually absorb that downward momentum.
Oh, so it slides the rest of the way.
Exactly. It allows the puck to slide smoothly for those final few feet right into the receiver's blade. And this brings us to the golden, unbreakable rule of the saucer pass.
Which is?
Never use it if a flat pass is open.
Never use it. Because it's too risky.
It is a totally unnecessary introduction of variables. Error is a difficulty you are adding to the equation on purpose.
That's a great way to frame it.
Right. Because if a saucer pass lands even slightly on its edge, it will hop right over your teammate's stick, and that results in an immediate turnover. You only elevate the puck if you are mathematically forced to by an obstacle.
Okay, so that's the saucer. Another situational tool our sources highlight is the snap pass, sometimes called the hard pass. This is when you use a drastically shortened sweeping motion with almost no backswing and rely on just a violent snap of the wrists. When do we use this?
You use the snap pass when you are trying to beat a spatial window that is rapidly closing.
Like threading a needle.
Yeah, for example, if a back checker is skating hard to fill a passing seam, a standard sweep pass might actually take too long to travel the distance. You need maximum velocity to beat the checker. Or you might use it to feed a teammate in the slot who is winding up for a one-timer, where pace is everything.
But there is a massive trade-off here, isn't there?
A huge trade-off. You are trading accuracy for sheer speed.
And the risk isn't just on the passer, it's on the receiver too, right? Because they have to catch this rocket.
Exactly. If you snap a rocket of a pass at a teammate who is only 10 feet away and standing still under no pressure, you have just made their life incredibly difficult for absolutely no tactical reason.
Right, you've panic passed.
And a puck moving that fast is so hard to cushion. If it bounces off their stick, the coach isn't going to blame them. That goes down in the mental ledger as your turnover because you chose the wrong tool for the environment.
That leads us perfectly to the environment itself, the boards. Using the wall as a teammate with the bank pass.
One of the most underutilized plays in the game.
Yeah, this happens when a defender is occupying the direct lane between you and your receiver. So you play the geometry. You aim at a spot on the boards so the puck reflects around the defender and towards your teammate.
Right.
It reminds me exactly of playing billiards or pool. You're literally calculating the angle of incidence and the angle of reflection. But the material we're studying makes a really interesting point about the, quote, table. In this analogy, the liveliness of the boards changes dramatically from rink to rink.
It's a huge variable that you have to account for. In professional NHL arenas, the boards are seamless and incredibly responsive. They give a very true bounce.
But in a local rink?
In local community rinks, the boards might be dead, they're covered in puck marks, and they usually have acrylic shielding that absorbs energy rather than deflecting it. Even the temperature of the building changes how the puck bounces off the plastic.
So it's super unpredictable. But despite that, our source says the bank pass is a brilliant tactical tool because it is inherently safe.
It is.
But safe how? You just said it's unpredictable.
It's safe defensively because the puck's trajectory travels entirely behind the defender's plane of coverage.
Okay, elaborate on that.
If you try to force a puck through a defender's legs or past their stick, they might intercept it and immediately counterattack. But a defender cannot cover the boards behind them. There is no opposing stick or skate in that lane near the wall.
Because they're standing between you and the middle of the ice.
Exactly.
Yet, I feel like I rarely see players use the bank pass deliberately outside of just blindly clearing the puck in a panic. Why is it so underused as a precision passing tool?
It's a psychological trap. A bank pass just doesn't feel like a real pass to many players. It feels like a desperation move. But a bank pass that connects on the tape is a completed pass. Period.
A pass is a pass.
Right. And to master it, you have to manage that environmental unpredictability we talked about. Mechanically, you must keep the cast flat, firm, and you must aim for the lowest yellow portion of the kick plate.
The kick plate at the very bottom.
Yes. The bottom 2 inches of the boards are anchored directly to the concrete. They will give you the truest, most mathematical bounce. If you hit the boards higher up, the plastic flexes, or you might hit a stanchion, and the puck just dies on the wall.
So aim low. Are there communication requirements for this? Because I'd imagine the receiver isn't looking at the boards.
Absolutely. An unpredictable puck that your teammate isn't expecting is just a turnover. You must verbally call the pass. You have to yell to your teammate so they can adjust their visual focus away from your stick and toward the wall.
Okay, so you have to warn them.
Yes. The unpredictability of the bounce is the cost of making the play safe from interception, not the reason the play works.
Wow, that is a phenomenal distinction. The cost of safety is unpredictability.
Exactly.
Now, to round out the situational passes, we have the area pass, sometimes called the chip. This is fascinating to me because you are deliberately passing to a patch of empty ice, not to a person.
Yes, and you see this constantly. When a team is trying to enter the offensive zone and a large, structured defenseman is standing perfectly at the blue line, totally denying entry.
Like a brick wall.
Right. So instead of trying to force a complex pass through that defenseman's body, the puck carrier will simply chip the puck softly into the vast, open expanse of ice behind the defenseman.
So you're turning a structured defense into a chaotic foot race.
Exactly. But, and this is crucial, it is only a smart tactical play if your teammate genuinely possesses a speed advantage or a positional angle advantage to actually win that foot race.
Right, they have to be able to get there first.
If your teammate is flat-footed and you just chip it into space, you are just politely handing possession over to the opponent's goaltender.
It's just a free giveaway. Okay, let's pull this all together and move into the truly tactical geometry of the game. We've covered the mechanics. Now let's talk about defensive zone escapes.
This is where games are won and lost.
Truly. So imagine a scenario for the listener. You are a defenseman. Mm-hmm. You've just retrieved the puck deep in your own right corner. The pressure is immense. Two massive forecheckers are bearing down on you, trying to physically pin you against the glass.
It's a terrifying position to be in.
The sensory environment is chaotic. You can hear their skates tearing up the ice.
Yeah.
How do we use the boards to escape this? The material we're looking at highlights a critical distinction between two plays that players constantly confuse, the rim and the reverse.
These two plays both utilize the boards, but they are polar opposites, and they are designed to solve completely different types of defensive pressure. Choosing the wrong one results in catastrophic failure.
Okay, let's start with the rim. What is it?
The rim is when you send the puck onward around the curve of the boards, continuing in the exact same direction the play was already flowing.
When is that the right choice?
You use a rim when a forechecker has successfully sealed the wall, meaning they have established physical position between you and the middle of the ice, and they are actively pinning you against the boards to contain you.
They're a roadblock.
Exactly. They are a roadblock. So by ripping the puck hard and low around the curve of the glass, the puck travels past their roadblock to a teammate who is stationed further up the wall, usually your winger.
Okay, so the rim goes onward past the pressure. What about the reverse?
The reverse is when the puck goes backward, retreating against the flow of pressure back the exact way it came.
And when do you deploy that?
You deploy a reverse when the checker has miscalculated and overcommitted. They came at you with too much speed, and their forward momentum actually carried them slightly past you up the wall.
Oh, they overshot their target.
Right, and because they overshot their angle, the ice they just vacated behind you is now wide open. So you bank the puck backward into that empty space for your defensive partner, who should be supporting you from behind, to pick up.
This is literally the martial art of judo applied to ice hockey.
It really is.
You are using the opponent's momentum against them. Like if they push you and successfully pin you, you rim it past their static position. If they pull or overcommit past you, you reverse it back into the space they abandoned.
That is a perfect analogy. You are making your decision based on the checker's momentum vector, not just their physical location on the ice. You have to read their speed before they even arrive at the corner.
Which takes vision.
It does. But there is a massive blinking red warning light attached to the reverse play that we need to talk about.
Uh-oh. What is it?
You must never, ever reverse the puck on hope.
What do you mean by on hope?
A reverse is entirely 100% dependent on support.
Okay.
You are sending the puck backward, often blindly, right into your own defensive danger zones behind the net.
Right.
If your defensive partner hasn't read the play correctly, or maybe they went to the bench for a line change and you reverse the puck into empty ice, you have just created a catastrophic turnover right in front of your own net.
And you're facing the wrong way.
Furthermore, your own bodily momentum is now carrying you the wrong way, up the boards, making it physically impossible for you to turn back and defend the mistake.
That sounds like a recipe for getting benched instantly.
It's the most common cause of goals against in amateur hockey, hands down. If you do not explicitly hear your teammate verbally call for the reverse, or you haven't visually confirmed they are anchored behind you, you just eat the puck against the boards.
Just take the hit.
You take the physical hit, pin the puck with your skates against the wall, and force a referee's whistle. You never throw it blindly into the center of your own zone.
Wow. High stakes in the defensive zone. Which transitions us perfectly into our next major concept.
Yeah.
High-risk plays and the never list.
Yes, risk management.
Let's talk about the philosophy of risk management. Because the source material outlines a brilliant framework for this. It states that in your own defensive zone, the standard for any pass is certainty.
Right.
But in the offensive zone, the standard shifts entirely to value.
It's a geographical shift in philosophy. In your own defensive zone, you are maybe 50 feet from your own goaltender. If a pass is intercepted there, it usually ends up in the back of your net 3 seconds later.
The penalty for failure is maximum.
Maximum penalty. Therefore, you must prioritize absolute certainty over creativity. But once you cross the center red line into the offensive zone, a mistake simply means you lose possession 180 feet away from your net.
Your defense has plenty of time to recover.
Exactly. So in the offensive zone, you can afford to hunt for high-value, high-risk plays that break open the defense.
Okay, so to enforce that standard of certainty in the defensive end, what are the universal nevers? What passes should I absolutely delete from my decision tree when I'm in my own end?
There are three defaults that govern defensive zone certainty. First, never make a blind pass up the middle of your own zone.
Up the middle.
The middle is the slot, the high-danger scoring area directly in front of your goalie. If you cannot make direct eye contact with the receiver, that passing lane does not exist.
Got it. And the second?
Second, never make a defense-to-defense pass horizontally through the slot.
Now wait, why not? If my partner is wide open on the other side of the ice, it seems like a great way to relieve pressure.
Because of the interception vectors. If you try to pass horizontally across the face of your own goal, and an opposing forward manages to get even the shaft of their stick on it, the puck deflects dead center in the slot.
Oh, great.
It becomes an immediate tap-in for the other team, and your goalie's momentum is usually moving the wrong way to stop it because they were tracking your pass. If a defenseman needs to pass to their partner, the puck must go behind the net, using the netting as a physical shield, or high up the boards above the face-off circles. Never across the goal mouth.
Okay, that makes total sense. And the third, never.
Never pass cross ice in your own end during a breakout.
Like from one wall to the other.
Yes. If you are on the left wall and you try to fire a pass all the way across to the right wall, the puck is in transit for a long time. It's a long distance.
Yeah, need time to get picked off.
Exactly. And if a forechecker intercepts it, your entire defensive structure is now caught on the wrong side of the puck, completely out of position.
Now, I will say, I know some modern NHL coaches design complex breakouts that intentionally use the middle of the ice.
They do, at the elite level.
But for our listeners building their foundational model today, unless your coach explicitly draws it up on the whiteboard and tells you to do it, treat those three passes as forbidden.
Agreed. Certainty rules the defensive zone.
Okay, so let's move up the ice and talk about a high-risk offensive play that I see fail constantly, even at the pro level.
Let me guess. The drop pass.
Yes. The drop pass. This happens when a player is carrying the puck with immense speed, usually as they are crossing the offensive blue line, and they simply leave the puck dead on the ice for a teammate trailing closely behind them.
When it works, it scrambles the defense beautifully.
But when it goes wrong, it looks embarrassing. You just leave the puck for nobody. Why is it so hard to execute?
It fails for a combination of mechanical errors and basic physics. Mechanically, players mess it up by actively pushing the puck backward to their teammate.
Wait, why is that bad? You want to get it to them?
Think about the physics of closing speed. The puck carrier is skating forward. The trailer is skating forward behind them, usually accelerating, right?
Yeah, they're both moving fast in the same direction.
So if you push the puck backward, you are sending a projectile toward a player who is rushing toward it at high speed. The closing velocity makes the puck incredibly difficult to receive cleanly. It usually just explodes off their stick.
So what's the fix?
A proper drop pass requires you to simply stop touching the puck. You literally just leave it perfectly dead and flat on the ice, allowing the trailer to skate into a stationary object. It's much easier to control.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Just leave it behind. What's the second error players make?
The puck carrier's momentum. Often, a player will consciously slow down or even stop skating the moment they drop the puck.
Because they're watching to see if it worked.
Right. But if you stop skating, the defender defending you simply stops with you, meaning they are perfectly positioned to just reach out and steal the dropped puck.
Oh, because you didn't take them out of the play.
Exactly. To execute it properly, you must drop the puck and then immediately accelerate, continuing to skate at top speed toward the net.
Acting like you still have it.
Right. Your speed physically drags the defender away from the puck, leaving it completely isolated for your trailer to pick up.
Leave it dead, drag the defender away. Got it. Okay, now we arrive at my absolute favorite part of this deep dive, because reading the rulebook history on this next play actually blew my mind.
The stretch pass.
The stretch pass, the home run. This is a massive 80-foot bomb from your own zone all the way to a forward who's cherry-picking at the far offensive blue line.
It requires incredible weight transfer and vision to pull off.
But the rules governing whether this beautiful pass is legal or illegal are a complete chaotic mess depending on what league you play in.
It is genuinely one of the most fascinating historical quirks in the hockey rule books right now. To really understand it, we have to look backward.
Give us the history lesson.
For decades, hockey was governed by the two-line pass rule. This rule stated that you could not pass the puck from your own defensive zone, across your own blue line, and across the center red line to a teammate.
So, no long bombs.
None. It artificially compressed the entire game into the neutral zone, creating that infamous dead puck era of the 1990s where teams just trapped each other in the middle of the ice. It was boring.
But that rule is gone now, right?
Yes. The NHL finally eliminated the two-line pass following the 2004 lockout specifically to open up the game, and USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, and the IIHF eventually followed suit. Today, you can pass the puck as far forward as you physically want. The red line no longer exists for passing.
Awesome. So we can just launch it.
But the only rule that restricts the stretch pass now is the standard offside rule at the attacking blue line.
Right. The simple rule that the receiver cannot physically enter the offensive zone before the puck crosses the blue line. But this is where I got so confused reading this source material. The legality of a stretch pass apparently comes down to, like, microscopic details about the receiver's skates.
It does.
Please explain this trail skate rule to me.
Okay, let's paint a vivid physical picture for the listener. You are the receiver. You are a forward straddling the attacking blue line, looking back at your defenseman who is winding up for an 80-foot pass.
Okay, I'm at the far line.
You are stretching your body to its absolute physical limits to receive it while staying on side. Your front skate is over the blue line, planted firmly in the offensive zone. Your trail skate is reaching backward into the neutral zone, attempting to keep you legally onside until the puck crosses the line.
I can visualize it perfectly. I'm completely stretched out, reaching forward for the pass.
Now, here is where the global rule books fracture completely. Under the NHL rulebook and the IIHF rulebook, which covers the Olympics and all European professional leagues, your trail skate does not have to be physically touching the ice surface.
Wait, really?
Really, they treat the outer edge of the blue line as a vertical plane. Imagine an invisible pane of glass extending from the ice all the way up to the arena ceiling. As long as your trail skate is hovering anywhere in the air behind that vertical plane, you are legally onside.
Okay, so I can have my back leg kicked way up in the air behind me, like a figure skater, while I reach forward to snag the puck out of the air, and the play just continues.
Yes, in the NHL and international play. But if you are playing under USA Hockey or Hockey Canada rules, which remember governs almost all amateur, collegiate, youth, and recreational beer league hockey in North America, that vertical plane concept absolutely does not
So is
exist.
this the rule for us amateur?
Under USA Hockey, your trail skate must be in continuous physical contact with the ice surface at the exact macroscopic moment the puck crosses the blue line.
You're kidding.
Nope. If your trail skate is lifted even one single millimeter off the ice while you are reaching for the pass, you are offside. The referee will blow the whistle and the play is dead.
That is insane. We are talking about a microscopic physical detail. Literally, the friction of a steel blade on the ice versus hovering a millimeter above it.
It is a massive difference.
And it completely changes the biomechanics of how a forward has to time their zone entry on a breakaway pass. You have to drag your toe.
It requires completely different body control. It's two rule books against two rule books.
Okay.
So, for the listener, the crucial pedagogical takeaway here is You must know your specific rule book.
Yeah, you can't just watch TV and copy them.
Exactly. If you watch an NHL game on Saturday night and try to emulate a hovering trail skate entry in your Sunday morning USA Hockey Rec League, the linesman is going to whistle you down every single time, and you'll have no idea why.
That is exactly the kind of obscure structural nuance I love uncovering. It totally changes how you watch the game.
It really does.
Okay, let's transition our focus. We've talked extensively about the passer, the geometry, the rules of delivery, but a perfect 80-foot rule-abiding stretch pass means absolutely nothing if the receiver has hands of stone.
That's the truth.
Let's delve into the neglected half of the equation, receiving and the critical first touch.
Passing is a symbiotic two-person job. Receivers hold exactly half the responsibility for a completed play. And step one for a receiver is communication, specifically giving a target.
How do you properly give a target?
You need to present your stick blade flat on the ice, well out in front of your body, and hold it perfectly still.
Why does it need to be perfectly still? I see guys tapping the ice constantly to call for the puck. Tap, tap, tap.
Tapping the ice to make noise is fine to get the passer's attention initially, but once eye contact is made, the blade must freeze.
Why?
If your stick blade is waving around in the air or constantly bouncing on the ice, the passer is forced to guess where it's going to end up in the future. That guessing game is exactly how passes end up buried in your skates.
Oh, because they misjudged the bounce of your stick.
Right. A still blade resting flat on the ice is a clear, non-verbal contract. It says to the passer, "I'm open, the lane is clear, and I want the puck to arrive at this exact physical coordinate."
Okay, so the pass arrives at that coordinate. Now we have to talk about cushioning. The materials we're studying are absolutely adamant about this.
Yeah.
Give with the puck, do not block it.
Essential.
I like to use a specific physical analogy here.
Yeah.
Crushing a water balloon.
I love this analogy.
Right. If someone throws a heavy water balloon at you
Yep.
and you just stick your hands out and lock your elbows rigidly, the balloon violently smashes against your hands and explodes everywhere.
Yep.
To catch it safely, you have to meet the balloon out in front of you and actively draw your arms backward as it lands in your palms, absorbing the kinetic energy over a longer duration of time.
That is the exact biomechanical action required to catch a hockey puck. You meet the puck out in front of your stance, and the microsecond it makes physical contact with your blade, you draw the stick backward toward your body a few inches. This requires what hockey players call soft hands.
What does soft hands actually mean physically, like loose grip?
It literally means maintaining a loose, relaxed grip on the shaft of the stick, specifically with your bottom hand. If you grip the stick with a total death grip, the carbon fiber shaft and the blade become entirely rigid.
Like locking your elbows for the water balloon.
Exactly. A rigid stick blade acts like a brick wall. When a heavy vulcanized rubber puck hits a brick wall, you get a harsh elastic collision. The puck bounces violently off it, often a foot or two away.
And a foot is too far.
In a high-level hockey game, a puck bouncing 12 inches off your blade provides all the physical gap a checking defender needs to sweep in and steal it. Soft hands allow the stick to actually flex and absorb the force of the pass, cushion the water balloon.
Let's talk about body positioning while receiving. The text states you should receive passes with your body open to the ice. This means your hips and shoulders are turned parallel to the play so you can see up ice.
Correct.
But I have to push back on this defensively. Doesn't opening your body up completely expose the puck to the defender? If I'm receiving a pass, shouldn't I stay closed, put my back to the pressure, and use my body as a physical shield to protect the puck?
It's a very common misconception. You might successfully protect the puck for a fraction of a second by turning your back, but you trap yourself strategically.
How so?
If you receive the puck with your back to the center of the ice, you have zero vision. You don't know where your passing support is, you don't know where the open ice is, and most importantly, you don't know exactly where the physical pressure is coming from.
You're flying blind.
Opening your hips gives you panoramic vision and an immediate geometric exit route. But beyond tactics, there is a massive physiological safety hazard associated with staying closed on the boards.
A safety hazard. How
Yeah.
so?
Let's visualize receiving a pass while skating up the boards. If you receive that puck with your back closed to the middle of the ice, you are literally inviting a forechecking opponent to hit you square in the numbers, driving your chest forward violently into the boards.
Oh, man.
Taking a hit from behind into the boards is one of the most dangerous, paralyzing plays in the sport.
The source material has a very specific rule for this wall safety scenario. It says, if you are taking a pass on the boards with heavy pressure coming, never turn your back. and never duck.
Yes.
But ducking is an innate human reflex. If someone is about to hit me, I want to turtle up.
It is an innate reflex, and it is a reflex you must actively train out of your muscle memory if you want to play hockey safely.
Why is ducking so bad?
If you duck anticipating a hit, you tuck your chin down toward your chest. This physical posture aligns your cervical vertebrae, your spine, in a straight, rigid column. If you are driven into the boards in that posture, the spine cannot bend to absorb the impact, which makes it incredibly vulnerable to catastrophic compression fractures.
That is terrifying.
It is.
So what is the correct physical posture when you know a hit is coming?
You must get your skates parallel to the wall. You open your stance, keeping your head up, and your chin actively lifted off your chest to preserve the natural C curve of your spine. You take the impact of the hit on the side of your body, specifically your padded hip and your forearm.
Skates parallel, chin up, take it on the hip. That is vital for anyone listening.
Absolutely vital.
Let's move to what happens immediately after you safely receive it. The source calls this the most important tactical part of receiving, the first touch.
The first touch dictates everything that happens next. A highly skilled first touch buys you a half second of time. A sloppy first touch costs you possession.
What's the guiding principle here?
The principle is this. You must receive the puck into the exact physical position it needs to be in for your next intended action, rather than simply accepting it in whatever position it happens to arrive.
Walk me through some examples of that. What does that look like?
Sure. If you scan the ice and see a checker closing in from your left side, your first touch upon receiving the pass should actively cushion the puck slightly to your right, physically shielding it away from the incoming pressure in one motion.
Okay. What about in the offensive zone?
If you are receiving a pass in the high slot, your first touch shouldn't just stop the puck dead in front of you. It should seamlessly drag the puck back beside your back foot, instantly loading it into your shooting stance.
You're ready to fire immediately.
Exactly. Or if you are receiving a breakout pass in stride, your first touch needs to push the puck slightly forward into space, so your next physical movement is an accelerating stride, not a complete stop to stick handle.
The text gives a fantastic mental test for evaluating this. It says, after your first touch, ask yourself, could you pass or shoot the puck immediately on the second touch?
It's a great test.
Because if the answer is no, then that first touch was wasted.
Exactly. If you stop the puck dead in your skates, you have to physically kick it up to your stick or stick handle it out of your feet before you can actually execute a play. Those corrective actions cost you a half second.
And in hockey,
a half second is an eternity. It is the literal difference between an unimpeded shot on goal and a shot that gets blocked by a diving defenseman.
Let's do a quick review pause here before we hit the really chaotic rulebook stuff.
Yeah.
What are the key pedagogical takeaways for mastering the art of receiving?
Four main things. Give a still target flat on the ice. Cushion the puck like a water balloon using soft hands and a loose grip. Open your body to the ice to maintain vision and avoid catastrophic spinal injuries on the wall. And ensure your very first touch sets up your immediate next action.
Beautifully summarized. Now let's dive into the mud. We've talked extensively about perfect sweep passes and soft cushioning, but we all know hockey is inherently chaotic.
Very messy.
The ice gets heavily rutted with snow, passes are terrible, pucks bounce unpredictably. Let's start with how to handle terrible passes. The expert advice here is totally counterintuitive. Kill it first, look second.
It goes against a player's ego, but it's the smartest advice.
Why ego?
Because the true measure of an elite receiver is what they do when they are given a garbage pass. If a pass arrives in your skates or trailing 3 feet behind you, do not attempt to contort your body and receive it cleanly while making a highlight reel play in one fluid motion.
You want to look cool doing it.
Right, but the physics are against you and you will likely just turn it over trying to be fancy.
So what do you do instead?
You use whatever anatomy is available. Use your bulky shin pads. Use the side of your skates. Use your chest to knock the puck down into the ice. Your only goal is to stop the puck's momentum. Secure it first.
Just deaden it.
Yes. Only after it is secured do you look up to survey the ice. You have to intellectually accept the lost half second. Attempting to force your original pre-planned play through a botched reception is the actual mistake that causes turnovers.
What if the puck is bouncing wildly or rolling on its edge as it approaches you?
Rely on the mechanics we learned earlier. Cup the blade. The physics of your stick blade angle do not change whether the puck is lying flat, hopping over snow, or rolling like a tire.
So cupping still works.
A heavily cupped blade will physically trap a bouncing puck downward onto the ice surface, and make sure you take the impact on the middle or heel of the blade, never the toe.
Why not the toe?
The toe is the weakest structural part of the stick. It provides the least surface area, and it will flex unpredictably under the impact of a bouncing puck.
Okay, let's wade back into the rule book because chaos means the puck frequently ends up in weird places, specifically in players' feet. Kicking the puck. I know from watching games that you are legally allowed to kick the puck to your own stick or kick it to a teammate.
Yes, that is perfectly legal.
But what are the actual boundaries of that rule?
This is a massive area for both tactical rules and physical safety. You can absolutely use your skate to redirect or kick the puck to a teammate, but there is a bright red line you cannot cross: kicking at an opponent.
Kicking at them.
Think about it. A puck stuck in your feet usually means a defending player's feet are tangled right next to yours in a battle along the boards, and skate blades are literally sharpened steel knives.
So it's a major safety issue.
A paramount one. In the NHL, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada, intentionally kicking or even attempting to kick an opponent is a match penalty.
A match penalty, that's huge.
It is an immediate ejection from the game and usually comes with a league suspension, regardless of whether you actually made contact or injured them. It's often just a frantic reflex when you're battling for a puck in a scrum, but it's a reflex that will get you thrown out of the league.
And the material notes that USA Hockey takes this even further, right?
Much further. Under USA Hockey rules, you don't even need to execute a swinging kicking motion to receive a major penalty and a game misconduct.
Wait, what constitutes a kick then?
If you use your skate blade to simply push off an opponent's leg in a non-kicking pressing motion just to gain leverage in a battle, they penalize that severely. The mandate is clear: keep your kick small, highly controlled, and aimed entirely at the rubber puck, never the opposing player.
Okay, let's talk about the most controversial kicking rule. Kicking the puck into the net for a goal. I feel like every week I see a goal reviewed on television for a distinct kicking motion.
Right. The universal rule across all leagues is that you cannot score a goal by kicking the puck directly into the net. That is disallowed everywhere.
Right.
But the chaos happens when you kick the puck and it deflects off something else before going in. Here is where the rule books violently split again, just like they did with the stretch pass.
Give me a scenario. Let's paint a picture.
Let's say you are parked in the goal crease. A loose puck is sitting in your skates. You use a distinct kicking motion to kick the puck forward. It travels 1 foot, deflects hard off the blade of your own hockey stick, and goes past the goalie into the net.
I mean, that sounds like an incredibly skilled heads-up play.
In the NHL and the IIHF, it is. That is ruled a good goal. The logic is that the puck entered the net legally off a stick, and a kicked puck deflecting off your own stick is deemed a legal continuous hockey play.
Okay, so it counts.
But if you execute that exact same brilliant maneuver in a USA Hockey or Hockey Canada sanctioned game, the referee will immediately wave it off.
Wait, really? Why?
Because their rule books explicitly state that no goal can be scored as the direct result of a kicking motion by an attacking player, even if it subsequently deflects off their own stick, a teammate stick, or even a defender. The kicking motion itself taints the entire sequence.
That is incredibly specific and very good to know before I go wildly celebrating a deflected kick goal in my local beer league.
Yeah, you'll look pretty foolish when they wave it off.
Let's move from the ice to the air. High pucks. A puck is violently deflected and is flying right at my face. If I reach up and catch it to protect myself, am I getting a penalty?
No, the rules permit you to catch a puck out of the air with your open hand to protect yourself or to gain control. But the strict condition is that you must immediately drop it directly down to the ice.
Define immediately, like a hot potato.
Exactly like a hot potato.
Yeah.
If you close your glove on the puck and take so much as a single skating stride, or if you attempt to maneuver your body around a defender while holding it, you will be assessed a minor penalty for closing your hand on the puck.
But what if I catch it while I'm standing in my own defensive goal crease?
Then the penalty escalates dramatically. If a skater, not the goalie, but a skater closes their hand on the puck while standing inside their own goal crease, the referee won't just call a minor penalty. They will award a penalty shot to the opposing team.
A penalty shot?
Yeah.
Just for catching a puck in the blue paint?
Yes. The logic is that by covering the puck in the crease, you have illegally denied the opposing team a highly probable scoring opportunity.
Fascinating. Okay, what if I don't use my hand? What if I try to swat the high puck down with my stick? I know high-sticking a player is a penalty, but what are the rules for just batting the puck?
The universal threshold here is the shoulder. You cannot legally play the puck with your stick above the normal height of your shoulders. If you bat it down while the stick is at chest height, play continues normally.
But if it's higher?
If your stick goes above your shoulders to make contact, the referee will blow the whistle. But, crucially, the whistle is highly situational.
How so? A penalty is a penalty, isn't it?
It's not a penalty, it's a stoppage of play. And in all four major rule books, if you high stick the puck, the referee does not blow the whistle immediately.
They wait.
They wait to see who gains possession of the puck next. If you illegally bat it down, and an opposing player happens to grab it, the referee will actually wave their arms and let play continue.
Really? Why wouldn't they stop it? Oh. It's an illegal play.
Because the opposing team just gained a tactical advantage from your mistake. The referee won't punish the innocent team by stopping their momentum and forcing a face-off.
So the lesson is, never stop playing and wait for the whistle.
Exactly. Play until you hear the sound. And this leads us to perhaps the most bizarre chess-like rulebook split in the game. Let's say you high-stick the puck. It drops to the ice and just sits there. But neither team wants to touch it.
Why on earth wouldn't a team want to possess the puck?
Well, your team can't touch it, because the moment you do, the whistle blows for your high-sticking infraction.
Right.
And the opposing team might strategically choose not to touch it, because they are trying to kill precious seconds off a penalty clock, or perhaps they actively want the referee to blow the whistle so they can get an offensive zone face-off.
Hockey chess. I love it. So the puck is just sitting dead on the ice. Everyone is staring at it. What happens?
In the NHL, the IIHF, and Hockey Canada, the referee will eventually blow the whistle to kill the play, and they will place the ensuing faceoff right there at the nearest faceoff dot to where the play was stopped.
Okay. But USA Hockey.
USA Hockey handles this completely differently.
Let me guess. USA Hockey punishes someone.
They do. USA Hockey explicitly states that the non-offending team has zero obligation to play the puck. If nobody touches it, the referee blows the whistle, and the faceoff is moved all the way down the ice, deep into the offending team's defensive zone.
Let me make sure I understand this. If I'm playing under USA Hockey rules, and an opponent high-sticks the puck in the neutral zone, I should literally just stand there, stare at the puck, and refuse to touch it, and the referee will reward me with a free offensive zone faceoff.
Precisely. Declining to touch the puck wins you territorial advantage under USA Hockey. Under any other rulebook, it just gets you a neutral zone draw.
That is a staggering difference in tactical strategy.
It pays to read the rulebook.
Let's cover one last piece of chaos.
Yeah.
Hand passes. Batting a puck with your hand to a teammate.
A hand pass is only legal if the entire sequence, both the initiation of the pass and the completion of the catch, occurs entirely inside your own defensive zone.
Okay, so strictly defensive zone.
But the critical, often misunderstood detail here is that the physical zones of the ice are determined by the exact location of the puck, not the location of the player's skates.
Break that down for me visually.
Let's say your skates are firmly planted inside your defensive zone, a foot behind your own blue line. But you lean forward, reach your glove out, and bat a puck out of the air that is hovering just outside the blue line, technically in the neutral zone.
Okay, reaching over the line.
You bat it back to your defenseman, who is standing deep in the defensive zone.
Well, both players are standing in the defensive zone, so that should be legal, right?
It is illegal. Because the puck was physically occupying the neutral zone airspace, at the exact moment your glove made contact with it, it is classified as a neutral zone hand pass. The referee will blow the whistle. The puck dictates the geometry of the rulebook, not your feet.
Incredible. We've covered the physics, the mechanics, and the incredibly dense rulebook. Let's elevate this masterclass to its final tactical stage. The invisible game. We are moving beyond the physical act of moving the puck and diving into hockey IQ. A completed pass is a two-player action.
It is. The receiver creates the pass just as much as the passer does. Very often, a fan or a coach will yell about a bad pass when in reality, it was just a bad pairing of cognitive decisions.
Right. It takes two to tango.
The player with the puck is constantly scanning for someone who is open, who is in a clean passing lane, and who is available right now. If the receiver fails at providing any of those three things, the play results in a turnover, but the passer unfairly takes the blame.
And the material we are studying makes a brilliant subtle distinction here between being unmarked and being available. What is the difference?
It's all about angles. You can be standing perfectly still in the high slot with absolutely no defender within 10 feet of you. You are completely unmarked.
Sounds like a great target.
But if a smart defenseman standing off to the side has laid their stick shaft flat across the ice, directly bisecting the passing lane between you and the puck carrier, you are not available. The puck physically cannot reach you.
So how does a smart receiver fix that? Do you yell at the passer to find a different lane?
No, the receiver has to solve the geometry. The receiver must take their eyes off the defender and look specifically at the physical passing lane itself, treating it like a tunnel.
Ah, look at the lane, not the player.
Right. You might only need to take one single skate stride to the left to open up a clean angle around that blocking stick. The receiver's job is to proactively find the open line of sight to the puck.
This connects directly to the concept of support angles. The text outlines three distinct angles a receiver must provide to the puck carrier.
Yes, behind, level, and ahead. These represent the three geographical options a puck carrier needs to survive pressure.
Break those down. Let's start with behind.
If you are supporting behind the puck carrier, you act as the safety outlet. This is a low-risk reset, allowing the carrier to drop the puck backward into space that the forecheckers have already vacated.
So it's an escape valve.
Exactly. If a team fails to provide a support player behind the puck, they literally have no answer to aggressive defensive pressure other than desperately throwing the puck away.
And what about the level support angle?
Level support changes the horizontal side of the ice. It's a lateral pass. This is extremely high value in the neutral zone and the offensive zone because it forces the goalie and the defense to slide laterally.
Making them readjust.
Right. But remember, our never list, you do not use level support, passes through the slot in your own defensive end.
Right. Keep it certain in the D zone. And the ahead angle.
Ahead support gains vertical ground. It is the most aggressive option, pushing the team toward the opponent's net, but it is also the most easily intercepted because you're passing into the teeth of the defense.
So a team needs all three.
A highly functional hockey team requires all three of these angles to be presented simultaneously. So if you are a player skating to support a teammate in trouble, the smartest cognitive question you can ask yourself is, which of these three angles, behind, level, or ahead, is currently missing? And you instantly maneuver to fill that specific role.
That is such a practical mental checklist.
If you notice a team struggling to complete passes, don't focus your criticism on the passer. Watch the players without the puck. Are they dynamically providing those three angles?
This spatial awareness is what makes one-touch passing possible, isn't it? Moving the puck before the defense can even process what's happening.
Exactly. Every defender and the goaltender is constantly reacting to where the puck is currently located. Every time you receive a pass and hold it on your stick, you give the defensive structure time to break, pivot, and reset their positioning.
You let them catch up.
Right. A one-touch pass moves the puck faster than human reaction time allows the defense to rotate. The puck lands in a space that was heavily guarded a second ago, but is now wide open because the defense shifted toward you.
But executing a one-touch pass under heavy pressure requires terrifying processing speed. I always compare it to playing speed chess. You have to visualize the board 2 moves ahead. But practically, how do you pass that fast when a 200-pound defenseman is barreling down on you?
This is the ultimate secret of elite playmakers, from Gretzky on down. You do not think faster, you decide earlier.
Decide earlier.
If you wait until the physical puck hits your stick blade to look up and figure out where your next pass is going, you are already dead. You have to constantly scan the ice, identify your next target, and make your decision while the initial pass is still traveling toward you.
You pre-plan the pass.
You must pre-angle your stick blade before the puck even makes contact, because on a one-touch play, the angle of your blade face at the exact microsecond of contact is the pass. There is no time for a follow-through to fix a bad angle.
Decide earlier, don't think faster. That is a phenomenal mental model. Let's talk about the final tool of the invisible game. Deception. Looking off defenders.
Deception is how you artificially buy passing lanes. Defenders are taught to read your physical cues, your eyes, the rotation of your shoulders, and the angle of your stick blade.
Because they can't read your mind.
Right. So if you firmly fix your eyes on one teammate on the left, you will psychologically compel the defender to shift their weight in that direction. Once they shift their momentum, you pass to a different teammate on your right. You have just created a passing lane out of thin air.
Just by looking.
Looking off a defender is the highest value, lowest risk deception in the game, because moving your eyes costs you absolutely no physical time or energy.
But the material strongly warns against the ultimate form of deception, the no-look pass.
A true blind no-look pass is highly situational and incredibly dangerous. It is only mathematically justified if your target is completely stationary, like a winger parked at the back door of the net, and the pass distance is extremely short.
So it's rare.
You should never use it as a default playstyle, and absolutely never in your own defensive zone. A no-look pass is essentially a gamble. You are gambling that the spatial arrangement of the ice hasn't changed since the last time you looked. And in ice hockey, the spatial arrangement changes every tenth of a second.
We are rounding the corner into our final phase. We have built an enormous mental model today. The physics, the rules, the psychology, the geometry. How does the listener take this vast amount of information to the rink tomorrow and actually practice building mastery?
A significant amount of passing mastery can actually be practiced off the ice. You just need a concrete wall or a mechanical rebounder. But the pedagogical key is this. Do not just practice sending the puck.
What else is there?
Half the value of wall passing is practicing the reception of the rebound. Do not just mindlessly whack the puck back at the wall. Intentionally cushion it, control the spin, reset your feet, and pass again.
Practice the full cycle.
Practice your backhand stroke equally. And when you get on the ice, force a partner to deliberately send you terrible passes, rolling pucks, bouncing pucks, passes deliberately aimed at your skates.
Why practice bad passes?
Players almost never practice catching bad passes, which is absurd, because bad passes are exactly what you have to deal with in a real game.
That's entirely fair. Now, I have to bring up a specific piece of research mentioned in our materials because it confused me initially. The Novak et al. 2022 study on using weighted pucks in training.
Ah, yes, the heavy puck study.
When I first skimmed this, it blew my mind. It seemed to say that training with a heavy puck boosts your hockey skills by up to 14%. So my initial thought for the listener was, throw away all your regular pucks and only use a heavy puck from now on to build mastery. But I need you to clarify this.
I am incredibly glad you brought this up because it is a perfect case study in how players misread sports science and draw dangerous conclusions. Let's look exactly at what that study actually measured.
Okay, let's look at the data.
First, the 14% boost they recorded was in shooting accuracy, alongside a 7 to 13% boost in shooting velocity. It did not measure passing speed, passing accuracy, or receiving ability whatsoever.
Okay, so I completely misapplied the metric right from the start.
Second, we have to look at the sample size and demographics. The subjects in the study were 13-year-old boys whose musculature was still developing, not fully formed adults.
That's a big difference.
And third, and most importantly, from a scientific perspective, there was no untrained control group.
Meaning what?
Every single kid in the study was subjected to a rigorous 12-week program of shooting pucks. So that 14% increase in accuracy likely measures the natural effect of diligently practicing a skill for 12 weeks, not necessarily the magic of the heavy puck itself.
That is a massive caveat that totally changes the takeaway.
It does. Now, the heavy puck is still a useful tool, specifically for building core strength and reinforcing the mechanics of your weight transfer, but you have to understand biomechanics.
What happens when you use it too much?
A heavier puck fundamentally alters the timing of your muscular release because of the extra mass. It changes how your stick shaft flexes. Therefore, you should only use a heavy puck in very short doses, and you must always follow it up by switching back to a standard 6-ounce puck in the exact same practice session.
So your brain can recalibrate.
Exactly. You force your nervous system to map the newly improved strength mechanics back onto the normal weight of a game puck. If you only practice with a heavy puck, your release timing will be completely wrecked when you step into a real game.
Scientific literacy saves the day. All right, we have covered an immense amount of ground in this masterclass, from the physics of the sweep pass and the kinetic chain to the historical evolution of the offside trail skate rule, all the way to the biomechanics of catching high pucks.
It's a lot to process.
It is time for our final mastery review. We've distilled this entire hour down to 5 golden principles that you can take onto the ice. Let's lock them in.
Principle 1. The mathematical reality is that the puck moves faster than any skater. Therefore, you must pass into space, not onto the tape. Read the receiver's skates to judge their true trajectory and speed.
Read the feet. Got it.
Principle 2. Mechanically, you must cup the blade and utilize a full body weight transfer to sweep the puck. Do not slap it. When receiving, you must provide a still target and cushion the kinetic energy like a water balloon using soft hands.
Cushion the balloon.
Principle 3. The first touch dictates the next half second of the game. Always receive the puck dynamically into your intended next action, whether that's steering it away from pressure or dragging it into a shooting stance.
Don't just stop it dead.
Principle 4. Being unmarked does not mean you are available. The receiver's timing, angle, and spatial awareness create the passing lane just as much as the passer does. Provide those support angles.
Behind, level ahead.
And finally, Principle 5. Know your geography. In your own defensive zone, certainty rules rely on the whim or the bank pass to escape safely. In the offensive zone, value rules hunt for the one-touch pass or the area chip to break down the defense.
Those five principles constitute your entire mental framework for operating on the ice.
Yeah.
Master them, and you master the game. I want to leave you, the listener, with one final provocative thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We spent this entire hour discussing the intricate mechanics of your hands, the flex of your stick, and the physics of the puck. But if the first touch determines everything that follows, and scanning the geometry of the ice dictates that first touch, then the single most important part of any pass actually happens before the puck ever physically touches your stick.
It's all mental.
Exactly. So the next time you step over the boards, ask yourself, are you playing this game with your hands, or are you truly playing it with your eyes? Thank you for joining this Deep Dive Masterclass. Take this framework, test the liveliness of your local boards, memorize your specific rulebook, and we'll see you next time.